wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Hello, I'm joined here by Dr. Krishlyn McGovern, our expert, Dear Science expert for today. How are you going?
Very well, thank you. How about yourself?
Yeah, no, not too bad. I'm very excited for these topics that we've got to talk about today. They look quite interesting. I did have a little bit of a breeze through. Let's just get straight into it. You've got this first one about moss
in space, right? Who moss can pass up that title?
Yeah, what else? So
moss, it can survive in the Earth's most extreme environment. So you find it in lava fields, in the Antarctic tundra, and in the Himalayas.
Yeah,
and so
it seems to just grow everywhere.
Grow everywhere, right? As long as it's, you know, got enough water and, damp, I guess. Yeah, but it basically led to this Japanese scientist going, well, if it can grow all these places, how's it going to go in space? Because that's how you think, right? Plants in space. You know?
Yeah. Let's test it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what they went and did. Mm-hmm. So getting things up onto a space station is obviously a big deal. So often we do earthbound experiments first to simulate space.
Yeah, right.
So despite what a lot of science fiction might tell us, surviving the vacuum of space is no joke, right? There's a lot of UV radiation because there's no atmosphere there to kind of protect us. You get extreme temperatures. Obviously, you have vacuum conditions. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough ask. And so what they did was they basically simulated space conditions on Earth and looked at three moss structures. So they looked at... The moss specifically they looked at was called the spreading earth moss.
Yeah.
I wonder if it had that name before they started their studies. But and they wanted to look, so they looked at a juvenile form. They looked at these specialized stem cells of the moss that emerge when it's under stress. And then they also looked at what are called sporophytes, which are moss produces spores, which are kind of a little bit, you can think of them a little bit like a seed, but kind of biologically different, but that's kind of the general idea. And these are encapsulated in a biological armor, basically. And they thought that, you know, a combination of space conditions like vacuum or cosmic radiation, extreme temperatures, would cause more damage than if there was a single stress alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically just pelted these moss samples with these different forms of stress. And what they found was actually it was the UV radiation that's the toughest thing for this moss to survive. And it was those sporophytes that was the most resilient. So that's where you've got basically the genetic constructions are in this biological armor. And they found, maybe unsurprisingly, that the juvenile moss was the kind of the weakest of form. Like it was the thing that died off quite easily. And then these brood cells, which are these specialized stem cells, they lasted a bit longer, but it was really those spores that held on. And they were even able to germinate these after leaving them at minus 196 degrees for a week.
Whoa.
Or the other thing they did was they heated some at 55 degrees for a month and they still germinated. So they were really, you know, that structure around that spore is being very protective.
Is that space-like conditions, those different temperatures?
Yes, kind of getting close to, it's not exactly, so it's right. Kind of the cheap earthbound version. They would have done some more extreme things, but those are kind of the two examples that are relatively easy probably to get, like 55 degrees for a month, that's easy. Minus 196, you know, that's when you're starting to use liquid nitrogen and you're keeping it for the week. So
it's
kind of the relatively easy experiment to do first and then get time, then be allowed to put some samples in a rocket, space shuttle, whatever you call it, that goes to the space station.
They tested this in space. How did it go when they did that?
So they basically, they made these little chambers that got taken up to the International Space Station and put on the side of it. So they weren't inside the space station, they were on the side, and they were up there. They went up in March 2022 and they came back in January 2023. So they spent about 283 days up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they got back to the lab, they investigated these samples. They only took spores up there, the sporophytes. They didn't take the juvenile moss and everything because they already knew it was going to probably die. And they found that over 80% survived, which was quite impressive.
Oh, yeah.
And then of that 80% that survived, only a small amount of them didn't didn't germinate. So most of them still germinated. So these things really did survive very well in space.
Mm-hmm.
They also did a little bit of chemical analysis on the chlorophyll. So that's the chemical in plants. That's the green that's, you know, collects the sunlight and everything. And they actually found that all the levels of chlorophyll were pretty normal, except the one called chlorophyll A, which is quite sensitive to visual light levels anyway. Yeah, and so they were like, wow, these things really are quite tough.
Like, yeah, for real. Like, yeah. They must be structured quite different, because I imagine that other plants wouldn't survive in those conditions
No, I think it's really is that idea that it's that sporophyte, that it's got that protect, and this is one of the things I was saying in the paper, that there's kind of that protective layer that's probably absorbing the UV radiation before it gets to the inside of that to that spore inside, which is where the genetic information is. Because one of the things UV, why we get a lot of skin cancer in New Zealand, right? It's because we got a lot of UV and it damages our DNA. And so that's why you start to get cancers and stuff. And so by having this sporophyte where it's kind of got this protective armor, it's kind of saving it from that UV damaging it, the genetic material. And so you can come back to Earth and grow.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good job, Moss. You can survive in space.
Yeah. Maybe a food source for the future.
Oh, yeah? Okay, interesting. Our next topic is around mosquitoes.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting one. You've said here that engineers have repurposed a mosquito proboscis to create a 3D printing nozzle.
So a use for mosquitoes, often kind of touted as the insect that, well, what do we need it for? And it's just,
yeah,
you
they
know,
just seem more like a pest than anything.
Exactly, right? They're one of the biggest disease carriers on the planet. So, yeah, and we all hate them. So, you know, if you think about that mosquito when it lands on you and it's got that big pointy nose that it stabs into and it feeds. So that's the proboscis, right? So it's that small little needle on the front of it. And so what happened in this lab was they're doing some 3D printing and they want to do high resolution 3D printing because they want fine details and they want smooth surfaces. And you often, you know, in aerospace or dentistry or biomed applications, you want to do this high resolution 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
And so often one of the ways 3D printing is done is that the material you're printing out of is pushed through a small nozzle. So it's extruded through that nozzle and it's laid down in the shape you want. So you can buy these tiny nozzles to do this high-resolution 3D printing, but they're about $80 a tip, and they're plastic or metal, so they're not biodegradable. So it's expensive, and you're just creating waste. And so what these supervisors of this grad student obviously thought is, surely there's something in nature. Engineers often look at nature, and they go, how can we copy that?
Yeah.
This lab went, how can we use something in nature? And so they told this graduate student, go out, look at what's around and what could we potentially use as a nozzle. So they looked at insect stingers, snake fangs, the xylem vessels in plants, which are how plants transport nutrients and stuff. And they decided that they were going to use the female mosquito's proboscis, this multi-part feeding tube, because its inner diameter is only like 20 microns. Mm-hmm. So that's like a fine human hair width.
They're tiny.
And it's basically 100% finer than anything that was on the market anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite stiff and it's quite straight. So that's good for printing, right? Because you don't want something that's bent up. And it could actually handle a reasonable internal pressure, like about 60 kilopascals before it just blew apart. So this is important because you don't want your nozzle blowing apart because it's not going to print very well.
Yeah, well, what would that small of a nozzle be used for?
Yeah, so what they've used it is with something called bioinks. So they've been printing three-dimensional structures where it's a biological material that you then seed with cells to grow tissue. So it's tissue engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't actually say specifically, or they had only just used a bioink. They didn't really say what it was or what they were going to use it for. They were more just showing they could make the shape, so they could use this mosquito proboscis, and that'll be the next paper down the line sort of thing. Now they're also going to go and look to see if there's any other things in nature that they could possibly repurpose. But the thing that caught my imagination was trying to imagine how they actually did the experiment. Like, how did they handle the mosquito to get the proboscis to then attach it to the 3D printer. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's pretty gnarly. I wanted to quickly shout out my brother, Xavier. He listens to the show every week, and he's always asking me if he can ask questions on the show. And the question he gave for that one is, do you reckon they would call them the mosquito nozzles mozzles?
Oh, that would be brilliant.
Which I thought was very clever. I didn't even think of that.
No, that's brilliant, hopefully.
Yeah. Shout out, Xavier. Yeah, surely they will. Maybe you can patent it.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get on to our last story here. We're talking about magnetic, turtles and magnetic fields and...
Yeah.
Yeah, what's going on here?
So the Earth has a magnetic field. So we're north and south. That's how our compasses work.
Yeah.
But it's even more complex than that. Any part of the planet that you're sitting on has a slightly different magnetic field to any other part. So basically we have this magnetic map over the globe. And a lot of animals that migrate very vast distances are actually using this magnetic map to get where they want to go or to kind of know where they are. But it's a bit of, we're not so sure about how they actually sense that magnetic field in a lot of cases.
Right.
Like how does the animal know what the magnetic field
it doesn't make any sense to me.
Exactly, right? And so there's been a lot of work recently about studying that how animals actually have this sense more. And there's two main hypotheses about how this could be. It's either chemical, so you would have within the animal a series of reactions that occur where each step of that reaction might be influenced by a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And so it's slightly different in the different magnetic fields. And so they build up their response to the magnetic map based on these chemical reactions. The other thing is, so maybe these animals have small magnetite crystals in them, which is an iron oxide. So it's magnetic, like it will align with the magnetic field of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that magnetite is basically aligning, it's influencing the neural tissue around it or the tissue around it. And so then that animal has a biological response that it now is effectively sensing the magnetic field of the planet.
Right.
So what this study's about is loggerhead sea turtles. So these are their distribution's referred to as a cosmopolitan distribution, and it basically means that they're over a lot of the planet. They're in the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans, in the Mediterranean Sea, and some of them have very vast migration patterns. So there's a group of these that hatch in the coast of Japan, and then they'll ride the ocean currents to Baja California in Mexico and feed, which is about 12,000 kilometers away, and then they'll eventually end up back in Japan to lay their eggs. So it was quite an impressive migration. And so what this group wanted to know was, is it more chemical or is this the magnetite sensing system?
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, this is really clever what they did, is they have developed what's called a behavioral assay. And so an assay is just when you're testing for something. And the behavior means that they're actually observing how the turtle changes its behavior to figure out if it's responding to this test. And so what they did was they had hatchlings, so very young loggerhead turtles, and they would put them into a magnetic field that modeled the area around Haiti, or mm-hmm. the area around Turks and Caicos, which are these islands that these loggerhead turtles, these specific ones, would go to. And when they were in this magnetic field, they would feed the loggerhead turtles. Right, so these turtles started to go, okay, we're going to get fed.
Right.
And when they get fed, they actually have this little behavior that they do this little dance where they'll basically push their head out of the water, and they'll kind of give a bit of a shake, flap their flippers, and so you can see that they know they're about to get fed.
Oh, that's cute.
And there's a video. It's very cute. It took them 2 months to train these turtles to learn this magnetic field was associated with food.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the students were too cut up about spending 2 months with these turtles training them.
Oh, absolutely not. I want to be there.
Yeah. And then what they did was there was a couple of different tests that they'd come up with. So the one of them was, okay, if it's this chemical system, we'll oscillate the radio frequencies or the oscillate this magnetic field, mm-hmm. and it should interfere with this sensing system from the chemical basis, and the turtles won't react. But they still did. So then they're like, okay, it's probably not the chemical-based system. What if we just put, we'll have a very intense quick magnetic pulse, which basically disrupts that magnetite crystal alignment, and then put them back and have them in this magnetic field that says food. And if it's this magnetite-based system, they should do nothing because they can't sense it anymore. And that's what happens. So they're kind of from this, it seems like this magnetite-based system is more dominant in this species. There is kind of, it's probably is a bit of a combination of multiple things, but this does seem like it's probably quite important to how these things sense. And yeah, it's just kind of really interesting to see and understand that better.
Yeah, my brother asked to this one. I mean, I imagine that this sense is kind of important for turtles specifically, like for the way that they navigate. But he asked if this, I don't know what this is, like this sense or this ability would be able to, if another living organism, like a human, for example, would be able to have this or...
It's really interesting. That's actually a really interesting question because I was thinking about this when reading this story. So probably... humans aren't going to adapt the system for ourselves.
I suppose we don't really need it.
In
the same way.
But what is happening, which is kind of a similar idea, is so our phones, they have GPS. We know where we're on the planet all the time. Mm-hmm. But to use GPS, we need to have connection to satellites, right?
Yeah.
That's maybe not the best system if, you know, there's wars and you take out satellites or if there's too many clouds kind of thing, or you're underground or you're under
like
the sea.
Internet drops out or like whole systems drop out.
Exactly.
Like
what there always is the Earth's magnetic field.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so what people are doing, a lot of quantum sensing is around making these magnetometers, which are really, really sensitive to sensing this magnetic field, not using magnetite crystals, but another form of... quantum technology, so that you then develop a system where you can use this Earth's magnetic map to now know where you are around the planet. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so it is the kind of the idea that is going to be used in the future, definitely, I would say, just kind of using a different mechanism to get there.
Whoa, that's awesome. That's such a great answer. Thank you so much. That's all of our topics today. This has been amazing. Just a shout out to Motat, who do sponsor the show. If you want to head down to Motat at some point, you can experience the magical Christmas lights, heritage trams, festive music, Santa visits, and thousands of sparkling lights over the next few weeks in the lead up to Christmas. You can get your tickets at motat.nz. Thank you, Krishla, for joining us today for Dear Science. Thank you, Motat. And as always, thank you, science. We will be right back after the short break.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.